The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and we have got an awesome read today. Before I finish Lynn Alden's lightning piece, it's coming soon, but I wanted to hit a piece today that I thought was really great. Stephen Lubka had from Swan Bitcoin, specifically from Swan Private, really, really great conversation. I've chatted with him in Bitcoin Spaces? I think it was a Cafe Bitcoin, if I'm not mistaken. And then he was on with What Bitcoin Did. And he's been talking about like the true nature of inflation and trying to clarify the difference between CPI and actual monetary expansion and why Bitcoin behaves the way it does. And this is one of those reasons why I think Swan Bitcoin is such a great, I mean, they just all signal. This is posted on the swanbitcoin.com blog, and it is an excellent little, it's just an excellent way to frame what's going on and to understand why there's, why the CPI, why the conflation of should Bitcoin just blatantly respond to the CPI, or does it respond to the monetary base, and what does that mean? What is inflation, and is Bitcoin an inflation hedge? So this is a really good piece. Really quick, before we get into it, I just want to thank our sponsors, and they are CoinKite, the solution to literally all of your Bitcoin hardware problems. Check them out. 5% discount with code BitcoinAudible. And then the Fold card, the debit card that gets you sats back on everything in your life. It is the way to always be stacking no matter what you're doing. 20% off with code BitcoinAudible. And then lastly, of course, Swan Bitcoin, the best no-noise, all-signal Bitcoin savings and onboarding service out there. Check them out at swanbitcoin.com/guy. With that, let's get into today's read, and it's titled Bitcoin and the True Meaning of Inflation by Stephen Lubka. Bitcoin is often described as an inflation hedge, so why hasn't it worked? Bitcoin is commonly presented as a hedge against inflation. Since Bitcoin has a fixed supply of 21 million and fiat is a mind-numbing bacchanalia of printing and excess, it simply makes intuitive sense that Bitcoin would protect people, investors, and portfolios from the ravages of inflation. So, why hasn't it? This is a fantastic opportunity to untangle one of the most pernicious myths that have ever beset modern economic dialogues. Defining inflation. It starts with defining inflation. Inflation is the price of things going up, right? Wrong. Do not pass go, do not collect 200 continuously inflating US dollars. When the term inflation was used for the first time, it referred to an increase of paper currency against the supply of fixed collateral, gold or silver, that backed the paper notes. It meant that each paper note was worth less in terms of its actual backing. However, there is no backing for our contemporary currencies. Today, people use inflation to refer to two separate things, and whenever you hear someone saying inflation, it's not always clear which definition they are referring to. One definition is, quote, the prices of consumer goods increasing, and the other is dilution of the money supply. So, which is it? Let's see if we can determine the answer to that question using two examples. Which of these scenarios should we expect Bitcoin to protect investors from? Example 1. The made-up country Randia produces 40% of global copper production. One day, their government is overthrown by anti-industrial rebels who believe that humankind can only achieve salvation by returning to a pre-industrial lifestyle. Overnight, all of the copper mines are shut down, outside of a few that humans continue to operate with picks and shovels. The price of copper soars on global markets since 40% of supply went offline within 24 hours. Consumer electronics increase rapidly in price. Electrification becomes exorbitantly expensive. Countries panic and increase fossil fuel-driven energy production. Manufacturing and construction are all impacted. CPI in the U.S. goes above 15%. Example 2. The United States government is overthrown by modern monetary theory rebels who believe humankind can only achieve salvation by giving every man, woman, and child 5,000 freshly printed dollars every month. Because this rapid increase in the supply of money is not accompanied by an increase in the supply of goods that people actually want, for example, food, energy, houses, electronics, there is just more money in a system chasing the same amount of goods. Consumer goods increase rapidly in price. Electrification becomes exorbitantly expensive. Countries panic and increase fossil fuel-driven energy production. Manufacturing and construction are all impacted. CPI in the U.S. goes above 15%. Which of these scenarios should Bitcoin protect investors from? A disruption in the actual supply of goods and commodities, or a rapid increase in the money supply? The answer is clearly scenario 2. The first example represents a tangible disruption to the non-abstract world of real goods and things. The abstract world of financial assets is subordinate to this real world. It does not have primacy over it. We will explore later on which financial tools, if any, stand to benefit from disruptions to the real world. The second example is a crisis on the level of the abstract world of finance. It is a manipulation of abstract instruments, which can itself be hedged against with other abstract instruments. Demanding that a financial instrument appreciate in value against concrete real-world disruptions is expecting to own something which makes you wealthier in a world that just became dramatically poorer. Becoming richer in a world that is becoming objectively poorer is not sustainable and cannot be available to all. Outside of directly owning the production and sale of disrupted commodities, this isn't a realistic goal. You don't suddenly gain a larger percentage of the wealth of the world solely by holding hard money when, for example, copper mines go offline. Bitcoin exists to provide users an alternative to irresponsible and fatalistic central bank monetary policy. After all, the headline cited in Bitcoin's Genesis block is "Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks," not "supply chains face new obstacles." So, is a dilution of the money supply the definition of inflation? Quote, "Inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, in the sense that it is and can be produced only by a more rapid increase in the quantity of money than in output." Milton Friedman. I agree. Analyzing true inflation. Inflation is solely the dilution of the money supply, the creation of more money. Consumer price increases are either caused by supply factors that no, quote, inflation hedge can or should protect investors from, or they are a lagging indicator of money printing. Measuring monetary dilution via increases in the prices of goods is a fool's errand. Why should we monitor the price of bread and cars to try to determine how much money has been created? Aren't there countless factors that influence those prices? Couldn't advances in bread making cover up actual inflation by driving prices down while monetary dilution drives them up? And doesn't newly printed money spread through the economy in an obfuscated and uneven way? Depending on how the money is printed, where it is spent, and who received it, monetary dilution can have radically different influences on consumer prices. Eventually, we will see an impact on consumer prices, but it will be asymmetric, generally affecting the goods the cantillionaire class desires more. and will manifest itself on an uneven timescale as the newly printed money interacts with the wide variety of real market forces. All of this comes together to suggest that measuring inflation via consumer price increases is like determining if you got punched in the face by how many teeth you have left. No lost teeth, no punch to the face. Measuring inflation. If we are only concerned with monetary dilution and not consumer price increases, isn't it a simple matter to determine the real rate of inflation, i.e. how much money supply was added into the system? Actually, it turns out not to be easy at all. To understand why, we need to first explore what counts as, quote, money. We clearly agree as a society that currency is money, and creating more currency is clearly adding more money to the system. What about treasury bills? High-quality, short-dated corporate bonds? These are actually commonly referred to as, quote, cash equivalents. Most financial institutions and corporations don't literally hold dollars. They hold these cash equivalents. In essence, bonds are claims on future dollars. Investors spend real dollars today to buy future dollars. This scenario is effectively net neutral on increasing the money supply, unless those dollars were printed from thin air via a central bank. However, if these bonds get utilized as collateral for future borrowing, and if they get infinitely rolled over and never extinguished, they do, in fact, represent an expansion of the total amount of money in the system. A bond is essentially an abstract legal promise to make certain payments. I give a company $10,000 today and they pay me back $10,500 in 2 years. There is no expansion of the money supply in this deal. However, if we now treat the abstract legal promise of the bond as an asset, it can then be used as collateral. We now have two things: $10,000, which was transferred from party A to party B, net neutral, and an abstract asset we are valuing at roughly $10,500. This is pure alchemy. Newton would be proud if he wasn't rendered penniless from financial speculation. By valuing the bond in today dollars at its value in future dollars, we have literally created more collateral, or money, from thin air. This is expansion of the money supply. Anything which can function as indefinite collateral is in essence money. Any money substitute which is close enough in function to money is itself money. It is money because it can function in the exact same way as actual money. So in specific circumstances, it's clear that bonds can expand the total amount of, quote, money in the system, but what about other assets? Are assets, stocks, housing, etc., quote, money? More importantly, do assets increasing in value represent an expansion of the money supply? Traditional economists say absolutely not. In fact, traditional economists say the only way money is created is when commercial banks engage in lending, because that actually puts more currency into the economy. However, if we define money as money plus any close enough substitute, then we are faced with a different predicament. What money and money substitutes have in common is that they both represent a form of abstract value, which is distinct from tangible value that, for example, a barrel of oil intrinsically possesses. Stocks increasing in value clearly means there is more abstract value in the system. In classic economic theory, this occurs because those stocks have actually added more real tangible value to the system. Is this classic theory actually true? Is every dollar that stocks increase representative of more real tangible value added to the system? More cars, more oil, more computers, more efficiency in producing these? Absolutely not. Stocks can be driven up purely by monetary dilution. Welcome to QE, baby. I would make the argument that most growth in stocks over the last few decades is driven by monetary expansion, not an increase in tangible value. And because the growth in stocks is driven by monetary expansion, the growth in stock prices is monetary expansion. It is the expansion of the total monetary value in the system against the supply of real, tangible value, which is in fact not grown in proportion. This is a fundamental truth of assets functioning as monetary substitutes, but it doesn't include the fact that people can borrow against the current market price of the stocks or homes, and that owning appreciating assets increases consumer spending of actual dollars. People spend more currency when their assets are worth more, mimicking a scenario where they simply have more currency. These both create the same effects as, quote, more money in the system. Measuring the expansion of the money supply is no simple affair. It can be expanded in multiple ways, some hidden, some obvious. The end result of all monetary expansion is an increase in the total monetary value that people can possess. As a result, the total dollar value in the world massively exceeds the total number of dollars by orders of magnitude. This endless monetary expansion is a fundamental reality of our fiat system, and is particularly needed in a system that is highly levered. Let's be clear. In theory, we could operate a fiat system without expansion. However, this only works if everyone is willing to pay their debts in full. It is not an inherent quality of fiat that the money supply must constantly be expanded. It is an inherent quality of governments that want to constantly issue more debt to finance spending, and who have no intention of or plan as to how to actually pay back those debts. When the system reaches a sufficient level of indebtedness, the only way out is monetary expansion. This is compounded by the amount of leverage in the system. Bitcoin and true inflation. Does the increase in the price of bread, cars, oil, or Netflix adequately capture this broad growth of money? Absolutely not. CPI is a useless tool for measuring monetary expansion in anything but an extremely noisy way. If CPI doesn't actually reflect monetary expansion, which is inflation, why should Bitcoin provide a hedge against rising CPI? It shouldn't, and it doesn't. What Bitcoin does do is provide a hedge against actual inflation, i.e., monetary expansion. When the Fed engages in QE, Bitcoin goes up. When the Fed tightens, Bitcoin goes down. When the government engages in fiscal spending via stimulus checks, Bitcoin goes up. When the government reduces fiscal spending, Bitcoin goes down. When assets go up, expanding the money supply, Bitcoin goes up. When assets fall sharply, contracting the money supply, Bitcoin goes down. Bitcoin responds consistently and predictably to actual inflation. It is a true inflation hedge when we define inflation correctly. Now, some readers may complain that this means Bitcoin behaves similarly to all other assets, which responds similarly to expansion and contraction of the money supply. I understand that critique, but think it has two major flaws. The first is that while Bitcoin is directionally similar to most other assets when the money supply is expanded or contracted, it outperforms all other major assets in environments of monetary expansion. Bitcoin is the purest inflation hedge because it is just money. Yes, tech stocks go up as liquidity floods the system. Yes, houses go up as interest rates drop. But stocks have idiosyncratic risks like debt loads, bad product decisions, competition, risks of obsolescence, and other real-world challenges. The same is true for real estate, which suffers sufficient maintenance costs, jurisdictional risks, and illiquidity. These assets function as indirect liquidity proxies in a system so awash with money it doesn't know where to put it. Bitcoin is pristine, pure, and unimpacted by the idiosyncratic risks other assets face. The value of Bitcoin is theoretically infinite because money has no ceiling. It is obviously practically limited. Additionally, why should the dollar-denominated price of any asset go up when liquidity is rapidly removed from the system? Monetary expansion is an alteration of the unit in which everything is priced. If you remove 50% of all dollars from existence in one day, is there any asset that would actually go up in such a liquidity contraction? No. The second critique of this complaint lies in the very asking of what sort of asset would actually purely hedge against CPI increases and not monetary expansion. It would need to be an asset that buys more things when there are fewer of those things. Huh? How could any asset, besides those raw goods and their producers, ever go up because the actual real stuff in an economy becomes suddenly more expensive in real terms? How could such events ever be good for any asset? Only two assets can reliably increase in this environment. The actual price of commodities, which can be speculated on via derivatives, and any company that is involved in the actual production or sale of those commodities or goods. Is that what we want Bitcoin to be? A strange defensive asset that only works during times of supply disruption and dysfunction? Or do we want Bitcoin to be an asset that can pull our financial livelihoods out of the swirling complexity of a system awash with liquidity, a system that is trying to cram that money into every money substitute available, even though none of them are perfect? Do we want a defense from central bank policy? Or do we want something which trades cyclically during commodity disruptions? The goal of Bitcoin is clearly something that stands in opposition to central banks and their policy errors. We have to accept that Bitcoin will not provide a hedge against CPI increases, and that to hedge against central bank actions is to be in a directional relationship with those actions. Bitcoin is money. The value of money is in direct proportion to a given money's acceptance as money. Money lacks any fundamental value. It is a virtuous bubble. It just so happens that our preferred money, Bitcoin, is in a tug of war with all of the other money in the world. For now, the performance of Bitcoin is intimately tied to central bank decisions. It is not uncorrelated to them. For some, this is perhaps disappointing, but I think that disappointment falls away upon closer inspection. It has always been exactly this. Bitcoin has always been a tool for the end game, an escape hatch for the inevitable dysfunction and failure of central bank monetary policy. In order to do that, it must possess a consistent relationship to the actions of central banks. Inflation is monetary expansion. Bitcoin protects us from losing value due to monetary expansion. At the end of the day, you either believe central banks will be forced to continuously expand the money supply, or that they won't. If that is the inevitable fate of this debt-driven, overly financialized world we inhabit, then all Bitcoin needs to do is respond to that monetary expansion better than any other asset. And that, my dear friends, is what Bitcoin does better than any other asset known to man. And that concludes Bitcoin and the True Meaning of Inflation by Stephen Lubka. Let's take a quick break and thank Swan Bitcoin, not just for this article, but also for sponsoring this show, and then we will get back in. I have a good chunk of notes that I want to hit really quick on this piece. So Stephen here is actually the managing director of Swan's private client, like, department. So he is in charge of the concierge services for Bitcoin. And, you know, like, this is why I'm a huge fan of the Swan Bitcoin blog. This is why I'm a huge fan of Swan Bitcoin in general, is they know their stuff. They know their stuff. I say that their newsletter, their blog, whatever you want to call it, like, the content that they produce is a massive amount of straight signal and no noise. And that is what their service is as well. Like, that is why I have had a Swan since as early as I can remember. I mean, I feel like they were brand new I started a Swan Bitcoin savings plan, and I have been buying every single week with them ever since. And it automatically purchases and it automatically withdraws. And their Swan Private service is the concierge service of that. Like, you can have the most basic Bitcoin savings plan that does not take up your time, that you don't have to time the market, you don't have to be like confused with all the noise and the crypto crap in the space. You're just going to get pure signal, and they're going to explain what's going on when anything is going on. If you want to truly onboard to Bitcoin and understand Bitcoin, Swan Bitcoin is the place. SwanBitcoin.com/guy is my link. And code Bitcoin Audible will get you 10% off the Swan Conference in LA, the Pacific Bitcoin Conference, happening in November. Again, Bitcoin Audible, 10% off. I will have links to both of these so you can check them out in the show notes. I hope to see you guys there. All right. So this piece, Stephen Lubka does such a good job of breaking down this concept. And, you know, this is why I've tried to describe, like, I've had people ask me, you know, why is Bitcoin correlated with assets? Like, why is it like people say it's correlated with the stock market. And I'm like, no, it's correlated with things that are hard. It's correlated with things in strict supply, which is the stock market. It's correlated with things that are monetized. So when you see housing collapse, you're looking at the contraction of the money supply. This is why number of times there have been conversations, or like, you know, Cafe Bitcoin or whatever it is, and people will ask or talk about this, and I always try to bring up that, like, you know, if we have another credit crisis, which I think we will, and I think kind of a little bit of what we're seeing is part of that, we're seeing a lot of contraction in all of the markets right now, obviously. There is the aggressive expansion of the money supply. The Fed has gone into trying to tighten very aggressively. I say that historically, it's the definition of a softball full of marshmallows. But from the context of what we've done for the last 10 years, it feels aggressive. The Federal Reserve is 2% or 2.75%, whatever it is quote unquote hawkish, which is really kind of comical. But what they are trying to do is curb inflation. They are trying to curb CPI because they have aggressively expanded the monetary supply. Now, look what happened during the monetary expansion. Look what happened to prices in the stock market. Look what happened to housing prices. Like, all these things that are monetary substitutes that have developed monetary premiums in the market economy because our money sucks at its one job, which we talked about pretty aggressively in Guy's Take 58 just recently. I talk about a lot of these different concepts. If you haven't listened to that one, it's really fun. I've had gotten lots of compliments on the ridiculous ranting. So I think we cover a ton of these, like, kind of inflationary concepts, the ethics of inflation, the difference between deflation, between saving and hoarding. Saving hoarding is just ridiculous. But why you start to see monetary behaviors in simple hard assets, in commodities, in stocks, in housing, in real estate, in these things, when there's no reason that these things should develop monetary premiums because they have high costs. Like, there's actually, like, a really good part towards the end of this. I'm a little bit getting ahead of myself, but I think this is such a great way to explain why Bitcoin is going to be the better monetary expansion hedge, why it is the purest form of inflation hedging or protecting yourself from the monetary expansion in the context of the things that have been developed as that tool. So real estate, a great example is, and I cannot remember what piece I read this in, but it just stuck with me because it's so crazy, is that the real estate around, I think it was around New York City or in some area within New York, like literally a third of the housing, it's like 30% of all the housing, all the luxury homes, in particular, sat empty because they were just used to park wealth. like when the monetary base was expanding, as the government is expanding their fiscal spending, and monetizing it through the Federal Reserve, having them purchase debt into existence, and then issue that money into the economy, whether it be through money substitutes, through bonds, through corporate debt and bonds, whatever it is, the illusion of creating reserves that aren't actually there or don't actually exist, which is the expansion of the money supply, you park wealth. You do not park wealth in dollars, because it will be destroyed. It will be destroyed in relation to the price of a stock. And the stock doesn't even have to be a good stock. It doesn't even have to report good earnings. As long as the company exists and there's the appearance of a growth in the network, the stock is going to skyrocket in price, because you're looking at the failure of the money to do its job. And that is where the expansion happens first. The CPI is totally irrelevant. Point at this. Man, he has a really good comment about the CPI. But it is essentially, I can't remember, I didn't save that one, and I'm not finding it right off. So it's about the fact that the CPI is a terrible measure. Oh, that's right, it was the one about the teeth. I'll find it really quick. Okay, yeah, here it is. Okay, eventually we will see an impact on consumer prices, just talking about like any sort of monetary dilution that will be poured into like financial markets and assets. Eventually, we will see an impact on consumer prices, but it will be asymmetric, generally affecting the goods that the cantillionaire class desires more, and will manifest itself on an uneven time scale as the newly printed money interacts with the wide variety of real market forces. All of this comes together to suggest that measuring inflation via consumer price increases is like determining if you got punched in the face by how many teeth you have left. No lost teeth, no punch in the face. I thought that was a pretty funny analogy, but it's a great example, is that you're not actually measuring the inflation. It's actually far more downstream than that, I think, is that the inflation is... CPI, from the context of inflation and consumer goods, is so far down the ladder, or down the series of dominoes that fall throughout the economy, and you don't know which things are close enough to each other, which path the money is going to take. You look at what the cantillionaire class buys. You look at where the money enters the system, and you look at all of the assets and all of the commodities and all of the hard goods, the scarce goods within that class, within that system, and you look at their prices. That is the better measure of monetary inflation. And then it is going to trickle down. It is going to squeeze its way into all of the other areas of the economy. But what's funny is that that's exactly why the cantillionaire class is so disproportionately benefited, because their assets and the stocks and the assets that they own get bid up in price massively. And as it trickles further down, what it basically does is it just creates this massive gap between the people who get that money first and the people who don't get it until it moves down to the economy. Wages are the stickiest things. Salaries and hourly wages are the absolute last things to go up in price, which means that everybody in the middle and lower class is in a constant struggle to get back to their current level of prosperity, of their current level of purchasing power, when monetary expansion happens. It's like getting a handicap. It's like, you know, having, like rather than, you know, in like Mario Kart or whatever, there's like the boosters. Everybody plays Mario Kart, right? Everybody's done that before when you're a kid or now, I don't know. You have the boosters on the racetrack, and then if you fall off, you have to get picked back up by the little cloud thing and sat back on the thing. That's the two classes. Cantillionaires, when there's a monetary expansion, they get the boost, and you fall off the track. The middle class and the poor get knocked off the track and have to start back. And you do that enough times, and there's zero chance of the middle and lower classes ever catching up. And that's when you get stocks. That's when you get the stock market and these things behaving as monetary substitutes, and the prices just go up forever. I think it was I don't remember. It was a piece that we read recently, I feel like, that was talking about how, you know, 50 years ago, 50 or 60 years ago, the median price of a house was roughly between two and three times the median salary, like yearly salary. So if you saved up half of your salary, it would take you 4 to 6 years to pay off a house in full, to own the whole house. Now, as houses have become monetary assets, they've developed monetary premiums in the markets, and they become inflation hedges, and people, rich people just park their money in real estate because that's the only place that will actually defend them from the monetary expansion and the ridiculously reckless indebtedness of the United States government and all of the debt that's pushed on the economy, the leverage in this absurd system. As houses take over the role of hedging against inflation, what do we have now? The median price of a house is 10 times the median salary. You stretch that 4 to maybe 6 years worth of savings to 20 years, to 30 years. And that's if it's static. But what's actually happening is that it is expanding in price faster than your wages are going up, faster than any of the productivity of the economy can actually catch up. And that's by design. It's necessary that it happens that way because we're financing every bit of new production. We can't keep up because we have to create more new debt. We have to issue more new money because our money is owed, is not only the supply owed back, but it's owed back with interest because it's issued as debt. We live in an economy where $100 is issued into existence and $110 is owed, which means essentially without the extra $10 being issued again as new debt later, there's not enough money to pay back the debt. I mean, obviously, that's a grossly simplified version of what's going on, but if there's only $100 in the economy, you can't pay back $110 debt. But as Stephen actually says in this, is it's not inherent to a fiat system. It is simply the way our fiat system works. And it's because the government desperately just wants to spend endlessly and never have to pay anything back. But I want to hit a couple things that I've saved from this. So one is just that, quote, I think this is just a really great... This is it. This is simply it. What is inflation? It says, quote, inflation is solely the dilution of the money supply, the creation of more money. Consumer price increases are either caused by supply factors that no inflation hedge can or should protect investors from, or they are a lagging indicator of money printing. So, an important note here is just about what price inflation means, and even in the case of its absence. So what happens when there has been an expansion of the monetary supply, but there isn't price inflation? So despite the clear presence of money printing, and this is something that a lot of people don't understand, and like I'll hear Keynesians argue this, is that you have to print money in order to make prices stable. So in fact, they even say that you can't expand the economy without printing new money, which is absolutely stupid. It's like saying that I can't build two cars unless somebody prints more money into existence, as if the new money in existence is determining whether or not I can complete two cars. It has nothing to do with it. I don't use the money for any of it. I use resources. Money simply allocates resources, and prices determine what resources can be allocated. You can't print, you can't write, we're richer on a piece of paper, which is essentially what you do when you print money, and think that you've created resources. All it does is reallocate it. So to say that the money, the economy, to expand growth, to grow 5%, you have to increase the money supply by 5%, and that we want to keep prices stable, what you're actually doing is you're stealing. So if consumer prices, if we get 5% more productive, if we get 5% growth in the economy, what we should all see is a 5% reduction across the board in the amount, in the prices of all of our goods and services. We should get all 5% richer with or without any raises whatsoever, just the normal day-to-day operations. We should be on a treadmill going forward because we as a society are sharing the added productivity of everyone through the deflation of the money. That is the natural state of economic growth. If we don't see that when the economy grows 5%, it means that it's been stolen from us. It means that somebody has printed that much money so that we stayed at zero even though we worked our asses off to be more productive. We innovated, we created new manufacturing, we became more efficient, but we did not get to share it. It all went to the person with the money printer in some diluted effort to keep prices stable by them confiscating 5% of all productive capacity of the economy, because that's what they would have done with the money printer. They just steal all of the excess resources and productivity that we produced. An incorruptible money, a money whose supply cannot be altered, would have captured that 5% increase. A lot of people think that if the CPI does not increase, that means that everything's all safe, everything's great, everything's according to plan. But you are still looking, the target of 2% inflation is not only stealing 2% per year through the counterfeiting machine, but it's 2% plus any natural deflation we would have had for having a more efficient, more productive economy. Which means that zero consumer price inflation is still indicative of a ridiculous amount of theft of our productive capacity. And I just think so many people lose that. So many people fail to realize that money printing is just theft. You know, just because prices don't rise doesn't mean that something very unethical wasn't done. You know, it's not simply about the fact that we want prices to be the same. And we don't. We don't. We want purchasing power to go up over time to reflect the reality of our increased productivity. But anyway, it's just something that I think a lot of people don't think about. All right, so he's got another quote. It says, in classic economic theory, this occurs because those stocks have actually added more real, tangible value to the system. Talking about stocks going up here in price. So is this classic theory actually true? Is every dollar that stocks increase representative of a more real, tangible value added to the system? More cars, more oil, more computers, more efficiency in producing these? It's funny, this quote got me thinking, the whole section about the stock market got me thinking because, you know, the stock market is really one of the best indicators or maybe correlators to the expansion of the money supply. It is particularly with how overly financialized our entire economy has become. Stocks have essentially become, and this is exactly what we saw in No Opinions article, was that, oh, if you have savings, you're supposed to invest it in stocks. Like, it's just kind of become this thing that is the norm. That is the savings vehicle. That's where everything is always supposed to go up forever. And it's just supposed to make sense. And it got, or that's just like the natural way, right? And this section kind of got me thinking about it because when you think about it in the context of a hard money, of something that has a truly fixed supply, the stock market should basically be a zero-sum game. Like, the overall stock market should never really increase in price. Like, the ability to invest in an index and just have it go up 5% or 3% or 10% or whatever, like, just expect it to go up every year, makes no sense in a fixed money economy. It wouldn't work. You actually have to be an investor. And that's like one of those things, like going back to the example in Guys Take 58 about the misconceptions and the rent-seeking savers. I use an analogy that that sound money, a fixed money supply, is like a pristine glass of water. It's pure filtered. It's a perfect zero. It's not like fancy water. It's not flavored. You know, it's not sparkling water. It's just the perfect clean water. And so it becomes the measurement of whether or not, you know, if somebody's like, oh, you want to invest in this shitty water? You want to invest in this muddy water? No, I don't, because obviously I've got clean water right here. But I would invest in a soda. I would invest in sparkling water. I would invest in taking that water and growing a plant, using it to feed a plant that produced coconut water. You know, like I would make something better than the baseline. When you add inflation to the mix, what you do is you just screw up zero. You take that pristine glass of water and you make it muddy, disgusting water. And what you've done is you've created this entire industry, this entire scope of investment potential in stuff that's bad water. Because when you're holding muddy, crappy, bacteria-infested water, well then, slightly muddy water is a legitimate investment. It's a positive return on your shitty bacteria-infested water to have something that's like slightly filtered, to have something that's like kind of clean, grimy, and taste weird, but it's clearish. Suddenly, that's a positive thing to invest in society, to waste capital on something that has no need to exist simply because all you did is you just messed up the clean water that everybody had. Like, in that context, think about, like, investing in a stock index. You're just throwing money randomly at stocks across the board. When what you should actually be doing, if you're investing money in stocks, you should actually be investing. The entire index should be zero sum, in the sense that the entire stock market doesn't just like grow unless you just have this huge expansion of new companies and new people in the network, people continuing to join the network. But what really should be happening in a broader sense is certain companies should be declining, old industries should be declining, so that capital can reallocate to new industries. Inefficient practices should be in decline, so that capital can be redirected to innovative, to more efficient, like more technological industries or companies or whatever. The amount of money in the system, in the economy, in the financial abstraction of the economy doesn't change. It simply moves from the systems that are in decline to the systems that are growing. The idea of just passive dumping money into the stock market and then just getting a guaranteed 3% return is the monetization of those stocks. Think about it. That is what a sound money would do. If the economy grew by 3%, 5%, a fixed money asset, a fixed good as the monetary base would grow in purchasing power by 3 to 4%. But since the money sucks, stocks have literally been monetized. They've developed, the stock market has been used as a monetary substitute, which comes with all of this risk, which comes with leverage, which comes with, you know, liability, essentially a cascading risk, because the entire constant growth in the price, the nominal price of these stocks, is dependent on the creation of new money. It's the creation of new debt. Well, then you always have this massive credit risk underlying everything, where basically the rug can be pulled and white, and people who have no idea what's going on and just threw money in a 401k and don't have the slightest clue why anything goes. It's just normal, right? We're just, a fish doesn't know why it's wet. This is just the way things are. Can get rug pulled by essentially the cantillioners, the people with the preferred access and who are big enough to consolidate during the crisis. And everybody is attached. Everybody is made vulnerable and put at risk by the next person's liability, because we are all tied together with debts rather than buffered, rather than protected from each other with savings, because we're a debt-based economy. And all of that is because of the way the money is created, the way that money expands in the system. So I'm gonna have to go ahead and close this out. I've still got like four or five things here that I wanted to say, but I'm out of time. I really like the one of the things that he closed this out with. I'm just going to read this section just because I like it and I think it bears repeating. So Bitcoin, the reason Bitcoin is better, this is the context, is the reason Bitcoin is better than stocks, is better than real estate, and why it will continue to be an inflation hedge, even though it quote-unquote correlates with those things, that's not what it's correlating with. All of those things, houses, stock market, financial assets, commodities, and Bitcoin, are all responding to and correlating with the risk and the expansion in the monetary supply. Yet Bitcoin is the one that will respond in the purest sense because it is a true inflation hedge. It's not a pretend monetary asset. It is not an asset that's close enough to money to be monetized. It is actually money. And it does no other thing. It is not productive. It is not degrading. It simply is that perfect, pristine glass of water. So here's the quote. Bitcoin is the purest inflation hedge because it is just money. Yes, tech stocks go up as liquidity floods the system. Yes, houses go up as interest rates drop. But stocks have idiosyncratic risks like debt loads, bad product decisions, competition, risks of obsolescence, and other real-world challenges. The same is true for real estate, which suffers sufficient maintenance costs, jurisdictional risks, and illiquidity. These assets function as indirect liquidity proxies in a system so awash with money it doesn't know where to put it. Bitcoin is pristine, pure, and unimpacted by the idiosyncratic risks that other assets face. The value of Bitcoin is theoretically infinite because money has no ceiling. It is obviously practically limited. And then the last one that I've got saved. Bitcoin is money. The value of money is in direct proportion to a given money's acceptance as money. Money lacks any fundamental value. It is a virtuous bubble. It just so happens that our preferred money, Bitcoin, is in a tug of war with all of the other money in the world. I like the idea of, like, money lacks any fundamental value. I have such a hard time with that because I believe that the virtue of money, it is a virtuous bubble. I have a hard time with that because I think it misunderstands the most important element, is that money itself is a value. The communication medium is a value. That's simply what its value is. That is its utility. That is its fundamental purpose. But in the context of thinking of it as a virtuous bubble, that's why I like the idea of money as a promise. It is a promise of a guarantee of other people's proof of work. And as a communication medium, the one with the highest monetary assurances, that is the purest money, that is not confused or influenced by a utility that has nothing to do with that purpose, the one that is the purest money with the highest monetary assurances becomes the most secure promise, and it inevitably prices out all of the other things that develop a monetary premium because they are simply subpar. And Bitcoin is in a tug of war with all the other money in the world, but unfortunately for all of those other monetary assets, Bitcoin is simply way, way better. So, with that, let's close this out. Thank you guys so much for listening. This will be a late release tonight. Thank you to Swan Bitcoin, to CoinKite, and to Fold for making this show possible. Code BitcoinAudible will get you 5% off your cold card and everything in the CoinKite store, and 20% off your Fold card, which also has CoinKite gift cards. Check them all out. I got links in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and don't forget to subscribe. This is Bitcoin Audible, and I am Guy Swan, Until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. You have been listening to Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.